Melbourne Writers Festival acknowledges the peoples of the Kulin Nation, the traditional owners of the land on which this event was recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present. Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation recorded live at our 2023 festival. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, please consider making a donation to Melbourne Writers Festival. As a not-for-profit organisation, inspiring, thoughtful and challenging discussions like the one you are about to listen to are only made possible thanks to the generous support of people like you. Learn how you can be part of our community at mwf.com.au/support. I hope you enjoy this episode.
Good afternoon. We acknowledge the Wurundjeri Boonwurrung people of the Kulin Nation, the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet, and pay respect to elders past and present. I've travelled today from where I live and work on Darug and Gundungurra land. Sovereignty was never ceded, always was, always will be Aboriginal land. So welcome to Melbourne Writers Festival and to Queering the Canon, and welcome to this incredible panel. I'm your host for today, Maeve Marsden, and we're going to have a grand old time. I will make my way. We've got a few of us here today. So we've got Kirly Saunders is a proud Gunai woman, a teacher, an artist, and the 2020 New South Wales Aboriginal Woman of the Year. She's also an award-winning writer, and her latest book, Bindi, written in both Gundungurra and English verse, is a remarkable tribute to family, friends, country, and creativity. And there will be book signings after the session. Claire Coleman is a Noongar writer who wrote her Black and White Fellowship-winning book, Terra Nullius, while travelling around Australia in a caravan. The Old Lie was her second novel, and in 2021, her acclaimed non-fiction book, Lies Damned Lies, was published by Ultimo Press. Enclave is her third novel. I wasn't prepared for a handheld microphone, but I'm going to make it work. I'm normally really good with my hands. It's the queer session. Come on, warm up. Look alive. Benjamin Dreyer is Vice President, Executive Managing Editor and Copy Chief of Random House. He began his publishing career as a freelance proofreader and copy editor, joining Random House as a production editor in 1993. We've got Bill Hayes, a New York Times contributor and the author of 7 books. His latest is Sweat, A History of Exercise. Bill is also a photographer with credits including The New Yorker, Vanity Fair and The New York Times, and he's served as co-editor of his late partner Oliver Sacks' posthumously published work. Next to me, we've got Chris Neen, an award-winning author of fiction, poetry and non-fiction, including An Uncertain Grace, which was shortlisted for the Stella Prize, as well as publishing 9 books. Are we up to 9 or 10?
10 if you count the little one.
Oh, we can count. As well as publishing 9.5 books. They have written and directed broadcast television documentaries and were the Copyright Agency Non-Fiction Fellow in 2020. Fat Girl Dancing is their latest book, and it's about Chrissy, not me. But it could have been.
But it's got you in it.
It does have me in it. I make a little cameo. So we're here to talk about queer writers and writing and hoping to learn more about each of these. I'm going to get rid of this book. It's ruining everything. These wonderful authors and the way that they think and write about sexuality and gender. As anyone who's come to my queer stories events would know, when I start to rant about myself, I was raised by lesbian mothers. And what this means is that my first introduction to queer writing was a book called Heather Has Two Mummies. And so I'm fascinated by queer awakenings because it feels like for everyone else in my community, a discovery of queerness had an air of the forbidden and the unknown, whereas for me it was really introduced in the home. So we're going to start in childhood and with these kind of awakenings and awakenings that might have been literary. And I'd like to ask what your earliest memory is of reading a book and responding to it in kind of a gay way. Chris.
Well, look, I think that probably the first really queer books that I ever read were science fiction, because I was a big nerd when I was a kid and I was absolutely obsessed by science fiction books. I didn't read anything that didn't have a spaceship in it. And so, you know, it was kind of Arthur C. Clarke and Asimov. And in these books, It wasn't necessary. Agency was given to aliens who didn't necessarily have the kind of genitals that we are used to. So their gender wasn't exactly as fixed in these books as it is in other books. You know, I remember a book that I read by Marion Zimmer Bradley called The Silver Medal Lover, which was about a woman who fell in love with a robot. And I loved the idea of wanting to fall in love with a robot, and I have populated the shelf next to my bed with lots of robots ever since. and I always take offence when they're, you know, they're those op-ed pieces about, sex robots, they're terrible and they're going to ruin, you know, humankind. And I'm like, I've got like about 18 sex robots. They have not ruined me, and I can tell you I love every single one of them intimately. So, you know, I think science fiction just set me up to be queer from a very, very early age, even though there weren't necessarily, you know, homosexual relationships in them. It was more about interspecies love. And then, of course, Marion Zimmer Bradley also had homosexual sex in her books, and that was another eye-opener for me, because I loved, like, she even wrote a non-science fiction book called The Catch Trap, which was, I think, the earliest real romance that I responded to, which was about circus performers, aerial circus performers, two men who fall in love, and it was so romantic. And I just wanted to be one of those men.
I love it. What about you, Bill? Earliest memory of connecting to a book in this way?
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that as a kid. Not really a queer writer, but I was obsessed with Roald Dahl and his novels for kids. I know he's a controversial figure now, but especially his book, James and the Giant Peach. Did any of you read that? About a boy who, I think his parents died and he had to live with his awful aunties, and he escapes by means of this fantastic peach to a happier place. I think I was the only son in my family. I had five sisters and a very strict Catholic upbringing. Could not have been more different than yours. So I think it was just that figure of the lonely boy escaping to a happier place.
Yeah. Oh, you raised a hand, Ben, and I thought you were about to raise your mic, but do you want to go ahead? Okay. What about you?
I mean, for me, I mean, it's like I knew what I was by the time I was, I don't know, six. Probably four, but six sounds more plausible and more polite, but let's say four.
Okay.
But I didn't have a word for it.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you know, it's like, you know, you're growing up in the 1960s and you become a teenager in the 1970s. It's like, there's not a lot of information lying around in plain sight. But I did, of course, eventually learn the word homosexual, which is very important because that meant that I could go to the Shelter Rock Public Library and go to the card catalog and go, you know, look up H for homosexual. And the two books that I particularly remember first finding on the stacks, of course, neither of which I would take home, I would just read them there. One was a work of nonfiction about homosexuality in England in the late 19th century and the early 20th century that was called, of course, The Love That Dare Not Speak Its Name, because what else was it going to be called? And the other one was a novel by John Reshe called Numbers, which is the closest thing you can get to absolute sheer pornography and still call yourself a respectable literary novel. What I've been thinking about in the last couple of days in preparation, you know, here I was thinking, what was that book doing in that library?
So God, it was waiting for you.
God bless whatever librarian thought, that kid's going to need that book.
What about you, Claire?
Well, I grew up in basically in country Western Australia, so exposure to queer topics was non-existent. But I was mostly aware of queerness in all its forms, but its complete absence in fiction. The fiction I had access to, the stuff I read, it had no queer content at all. The first time I was aware of the existence of something that could be queerness was in Lord of the Rings, because don't argue with me, Frodo and Sam were gay.
No one here is going to argue with you. Everyone, on that, Claire.
That is a fact. Okay, maybe Frodo bisexual, Sam definitely gay, or the other way around. Sam got married. Maybe bye. Frodo, bachelor all his life.
We don't need you to like write fan fiction live.
No, but a lot of the Rings. And also, I became aware quite young that the way the Lord of the Rings is written, if you read between the lines, Gimli and Legolas were a couple as well, the way it was written. Because Gimli gave up his life to go spend for eternity with Legolas.
How romantic.
It's so romantic. Gimli and Legolas are such a cute couple.
Kelly, what about you?
I love that. I grew up reading a lot of books, but I feel like in the 90s and 2000s in the Southern Highlands, there probably weren't a bunch of queer-friendly picture books in this very, like, white conservative town. But I did grow up playing hockey and also going to pony club, and I think that's pretty gay.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't have to read the books to know what was going on, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you, as well as being a poet, you write children's books now, and we've got this kind of moral panic around queers daring to read to children. How does your identity now inform the way you write for children?
Yeah, I've just finished, I've sent it off to two publishers, so it might turn into nothing, who knows, but a graphic novel with a non-gender binary lead, and they're in a relationship with a woman, so it's definitely changing the way that I write. And the novel that I'm working on, Yarraman, is a queer romance. Mm. So, yeah.
Beautiful. Obviously, there are these little early awakenings, and at a certain point we work out that there are others like us. How delightful. What books did you read that kind of connected you to a sense of queerness as a community? Not an identity, but a place you could go and find, yeah, community. Bill?
For me, the book was States of Desire by Edmund White. I'm sure a lot of you know Edmund White, who's written, published dozens of books, novels, nonfiction, biographies. I read the book in paperback.
Yeah.
In 1983, this is my original copy, which was in perfect condition until about a half hour ago when I opened it and the binding broke. Oh. It's okay.
It was waiting for this panel. It was waiting to be present at this panel before it.
But States of Desire is not really a well-known Edmund White book. I think it's amazing. It's a time capsule. He published it in 1980, and it's a travelogue, a reported book in which he traveled to cities around the United States, everywhere from Seattle to Portland to L.A. to Kansas City to Florida to New York to Washington. It's very personal. It's got a very strong voice. And I was just thinking that the title could have been Queer Nation, because it's about being gay in America in 1980. But I read it in 1983, by which time the AIDS pandemic had emerged. And so there's a really poignant introduction that he writes to this edition. Still really early days in the pandemic. Only 1,300 people had died by that point. But he's aware of how much things have changed so quickly. And of course, he was a very important figure in the early AIDS movement as a co-founder of GMHC and so many other things that he did. But it's a great book. And I'm a nonfiction writer and memoirist. And I love the voice of his nonfiction work especially.
I was going to ask you about the way you infuse, you infuse nonfiction. I mean, Sweat is a history. It's got packed with fact, but then it's got so much of you in it and so much of the personal. Is he part of what influenced that style of writing?
I think definitely. I was rereading it over the last few days, and he just has such a strong voice, you know, and he also doesn't pretend that he's telling the whole story. He's very upfront about the fact that it's about gay men, that it's not about lesbians as well. It's not about older people. It's a certain subset. He wrote it when he was about 40, so he's sort of seeking out his own peer group, I guess. It doesn't tell the whole story, but that personal voice definitely had an influence on me as a writer, for sure.
And I suppose there's something as well about queerness and always knowing that we're on the outside, meaning that we're always able to acknowledge that we can't tell the full story,
yeah.
that all history is personal and one's own perspective.
Yeah.
Ben, you sort of there was lots of chat among Bill and Ben backstage of your kind of shared histories. What are some of the books that connected you to the community?
I mean, for me, the way in wasn't necessarily one book per se. It was my discovery of the ongoing existence of Christopher Street Magazine, which was the you know, literary journal for mostly gay, but gay and lesbian writing, and it was my means of discovering that there was this very thriving community that had already come up, that was filled with writers that included people like Edmund White, included people like Andrew Holleran, writers whose careers, whose reputations are more important to me because I read them when I was young, like Robert Farrow. But it was like, wow, there's all this stuff going on. And one of the key figures in that, as Billy and I were discussing before, is an editor named Michael Denneny, who died just a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, Michael Denneny was the great gay American editor. And even though when I was, starting to read Christopher Street and just taking all this stuff in, I hadn't even thought that I would be making my way into publishing, but it was like, that's when I learned that there is such a thing as gay publishing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, this is a potentially irritating question, but what is gay publishing? Like, how does your identity impact the way you work?
Well,
I mean, I know what gay publishing is in the sense of the magazine, but yeah. Like how, if you say he's one of the great gay publishers, how does that come up in your career?
The way it worked when I came in is in part because of my acquaintance with some gay writers is how I ended up first freelancing, proofreading for St. Martin's Press, which is where Michael Denneny was situated. And that was his mission. His mission was gay literature. Now, me end up a few years later working at Random House. It's like, well, my job isn't one book or a kind of book. My job is everything that we do. And I don't buy them, I just make them happen.
You make them better.
I try. But what I can say, even though, I don't necessarily have, my hand on what we do, but I'm certainly gratified these last few years in particular to see that the company has recognized the value of bringing in not only queer editors, but editors of color, with the idea that we can't just wait for everybody who's currently working in the house to grow old, retire, and die. We need to expand. And so there's lots more stuff now than there was in all the time I've been working for the company. And it's really gratifying.
Yeah. I'm interested in how we define queer literature, whether it's possible to kind of put a boundary around the genre. Does anyone want to give it a shot? You can go ahead if you're already on a roll.
No, I'm just thinking.
Okay, we'll all just think amongst ourselves. Chris?
I've got a thought on that, actually. And it doesn't have to have queer characters at the centre. It kind of has to be outsider stories. I feel like something that really connects with queers everywhere is that most of us have felt like outsiders in some way our entire life. And there's real, like, the world is divided into insider stories and outsider stories. And I know this because my partner writes insider stories and I write outsider stories. And when we used to write together, we used to just have terrible arguments about who was the protagonist. Because I would always choose this fringe person who just was not fitting into the community. And he would always choose this person who was at the center of a community going, I don't want to be here anymore, I want out. So, we kind of met in the middle of our journeys of him kind of going out of the mainstream and me always being on the outside going, I wish I was in there. And I think that they're two different, very different perspectives. So I think outsider stories are the ones that really relate to, and that's why science fiction and that's why Tolkien kind of, although Tolkien was a bit of an insider, I think, but the characters are outsiders.
Would you agree, Curly? Is that...
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I also feel like there's a bit of a journey in it, right? Most of the queer texts that I've read or feel that I relate to, I find there's the self-acceptance thing, which we're like, finally someone is accepting themselves. I've accepted myself. We're on this journey together. It can also be the journey of trying to get other people to accept, I think, is something that I see in queer text. So I'm not sure if the journey is in there somehow. Mm. Yeah.
I like that.
I think it's to the story itself and the characters. The other Ed White book that made a huge impact on me was A Boy's Own Story, his novel from 1983 about a young boy discovering he was gay, teenager. I read it in 1983, the year I graduated college. I was just on the cusp of coming out, which I did the next year, and it gave me a certain amount of courage. I mean, it's a beautiful, tender book and beautifully written, and it, along with Audrey and Rich, who we'll talk about as well, those two are the most important figures for me.
Yeah. We've talked a little bit about some of the books that we're nostalgic for, but I'm interested in kind of contemporary queer writers. I know that, Curly, you had a couple that you were going to refer to. Who are some of the contemporary queer writers who inspire your work?
Oh, I think Ellen Van Nieuwen is right up there on my list. Throat is something I pick it up all the time. I read from it regularly. I love it. Anangamai Manajirali was a collection that came out for World Pride this year and just features a lot of Black First Nations, queer writers from, many different backgrounds. And I think both are really stunning collections because they speak about everyday experience as queer folk. And I think when we read us sometimes, we're looking at this, this life that's happening in it, outside of the everyday. It's not just the grocery store or the walk through town, and those are featured in both of these books in really stunning ways. And I dog-eared a page.
Yeah, we'd love to hear a bit.
And I read. I might not do it as good as Ellen would, who also has another book out, so please go and check out Ellen's new book. This is Pleasure Seeking, after Malcolm Tarek, who said, "What if the ancestors are watching us fuck?" Babe, you're not going to find good sex tips in the search bar. It's a colonized capitalist space. All the first hits are white. You're just giving them your data. You'll need a sister to lead you astray. Tell you if you push your fingers just so, she'll always be. Wait, what are you into? Hot consent, anti-racist love, deep feelings, politically progressive desire and negotiated risk. Okay. In the T-bar position, your maps transpose land, sea, sky, occupation, reoccupation, decolonization. Tell her. Go on, tell her. You're not really dating unless you're dating each other's ancestors.
Beautiful, thank you.
Ellen's fantastic.
Yes, spectacular. Claire, you also, when we were chatting prior, said that it was a book of verse that is your sort of foundational queer text. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
If people ask often why I write the weird way I write, which is, if you haven't read my books, I can't keep the poetry out of my prose. Mm. I just can't. I try to write straight prose, but I end up with this weird sort of poetry in a prose paragraph form. It's nuts, but I can't control the way I write, just the way I write. But the foundation to that was a queer book, which I found out today, speaking to random people at another writers' festival where I was this morning, that it's now an obscure book, which is The Monkey's Mask by Dorothy Porter.
It's not obscure.
Which, if you've never heard of it, it's a very raunchy detective novel written in verse by a very fine poetry academic. And it's odd. And I remember the story of her writing it, which was she tried to write a YA novel to make the money, because there's lots of money YA novels, and that failed. So she sat down to write the most self-indulgent thing she could write, which is a detective novel in verse. And it became the big hit that made her a fortune. So it's like this real odd thing. And it taught me two things. One is that it taught me to, if you want to write something, there's nothing wrong with writing something self-indulgent, because then other people might have the same indulgences as you. So you just write that weird thing that you want to exist in the world, because you don't know. There might be thousands of other people who want that thing to exist in the world and they'll read it. And the other thing it taught me is not to be afraid of writing in a really weird style, because she did.
Mm.
And I remember the first time I read it, I bought it. I saw the movie first. They made a movie of it, a movie of a verse novel. It's just an odd idea anyway. I saw the movie with the lesbian club of La Trobe University back a long time ago, as you do. And then I bought the book, and I started reading it on the train from Melbourne to Rushall Station. And I got off at Rushall Station, which I live near. I got off at Rushall Station and sat down the park bench and finished the book before I moved.
I love that.
And if a book can do that, you should read it, really.
Truly. Chris, of your 9.5 books, which is the most self-indulgent?
Oh, out of my books, which is the most self-indulgent?
Yeah, I love that notion of writing stuff that is a self-indulgence and writing the book you deeply want to write. Which of yours is that?
Look, ultimately, the Adventures of Holly White and the Incredible Sex Machine was...
it was an excellent title, can I just say.
I love that title. It wasn't a book. It was a book that I was asked to write by my publisher, but I was asked to write a sexy book, a sexy women's erotica that had no perversity and a happy ending was the kind of... And I took the term happy ending in a little bit of a strange direction, because there's a, you know, there is a global orgasm at the end of that book, and I thought, well, that's a happy ending, so I've got that. But as I was researching this book, which was supposed to be based on sex fiction, erotic fiction classics throughout the ages, I discovered Wilhelm Reich, who believed that the orgasm, the energy that came out of orgasm could be captured and made into a weapon and fired up at the clouds to create rain and all sorts of things. And I was just, and this is a real person, he was Freud's brightest student, and I became obsessed by Wilhelm Reich, went down the rabbit hole, and then decided that my protagonist would be someone whose vagina was glowed and had this orgasmic energy that could be then used, weaponized, and she was being chased by the government. So I think I didn't write the bride strip bear, which is what I was supposed to be writing. And I did have in the orgasm scene at the end, there were some
no spoilers.
Bits that probably were a little bit perverse in the crowd. But, you know, I finished the book and I loved it, and it was very self-indulgent and it was fun and hilarious, and I chuckled to myself the whole way through writing it.
That's magnificent. I got slightly distracted from the question prior, which I want a few more people's input into, which is about contemporary queer writers whose work you love. Ben, you must read, I mean, how many books a year do you put away?
I mean... There's the reading that I like to do for myself.
Yes.
There's the reading that I'm doing in research for the next book that I'm writing. So that's a lot of reading. But what I try to do at work is at least dip in to just about everything that we publish. You know, check it at the Bound Galley stage. It's like, just make sure that everybody's doing what they're supposed to be doing. And often, just because of the pressures of time, it's like those 30 pages and then next. But every now and then, something absolutely grabs my eyes and I can't stop and I take it home. And the last one that did that was Tori Peters' novel, Detransition Baby.
I love Tori's end of the world apocalyptic stuff. There's another book with zombies. And, you know, having to eat people's testicles to get your... to get your estrogen, which is apparently where estrogen's kept. I now know you can get estrogen from dead men's testicles.
Who knew?
Who knew? Tori, apparently.
Tori, apparently.
I just think she's amazing.
Yeah. It is brilliant. What about you, Bill?
This isn't directly answering your question, but...
That's fine. Go wild.
The first person in book I thought of was my late partner Oliver Sacks's last book, published in his lifetime, his autobiography, On the Move. Now, Oliver had not come out his whole life, very private. We were in a relationship, but he never spoke about it until he wrote On the Move, in which he talked about his sexual identity, his struggle with coming out, and about our relationship. And it's a beautiful book and so candid and simply told. And that is still a very moving book to me. And we were so different in that way, because I've published 7 books and I've been out, you know, in all of my books. But for him, that was never the case until On the Move, which was published just 3 months before he died.
You write so beautifully about your relationship with Oliver. What's it like for this audience who may not have read you writing about it, living with two writers? I know you didn't live together, but how does your practice impact each other? Do you ever sort of go, oh, that's how you do it?
I think we had a lot of influence on each other. At the end of each day, we'd come together and he would read to me what he had written that day. This may be hard for some people to believe, but in his apartment, there was no computer, no cell phone, no Wi-Fi. He never wrote an email or text in his life. And he wrote all of his books and articles and case histories by hand on pads of paper. He was lucky he had an assistant who then transcribed onto a computer for the publishing house. So he would read to me at the end of the day. I would tell him what I thought, and I would read to him what I'd written perhaps. But in those years, I was doing a lot of photography, so I would show him my photographs, and Oliver was knowledgeable about a lot of things, not just neurology, but botany and geology and the elements, and obsessed with these things. And he knew a lot about the history of photography. So he was a great photography critic too, and unafraid to tell me if a photo was good or bad.
Can I add?
Yeah, please.
Helena Fox's The Quiet and the Loud came out not long ago, and it's stunning. Go and read it. Yeah.
Tell us why.
Oh, I just think the portrayal of queer characters, the warmth and friendship between the characters is stunning. And like Claire, it's poetry, you know, meets prose. It's just beautiful. Go and read it.
Thank you. Claire, you write speculative fiction, and you've spoken at length in the past about kind of dystopias and the idea that for some people dystopia is this scary future, but for some people it is a present. Can you speak to that idea and also talk to us about how you queer the genre?
Well, the thing about dystopia, and this is the second time this weekend I've had to say this, which is fine. Every dystopia...
I'd be a different audience. So
yeah, completely different audience. Every dystopia is a utopia to somebody else. Yeah. Because if every dystopia was a dystopia to everybody, everybody would change it. Mm. That's with somebody benefiting or there's no dystopia. That's the fact. And for queer people for a couple of hundred years, the dystopia has been on us and imposed upon us by the mainstream society. So to queer dystopia, we just have to write honestly. Really, it's that simple. Just like indigenizing dystopia for indigenous people, just write honestly. We are living in a dystopia. Just write our lives. Here you go. It's a dystopia. So in a way... And until I remember in years ago, queer fiction and queer film was even worse. You knew it was queer fiction because everyone died. Yeah. or you knew it was queer film because everyone died. And in fact, I remember someone, I was queer officer at La Trobe Uni for a while, and someone wanted to put a queer night on. And they said, can we have a queer film night and have films where no one dies? And we started to do that. But we couldn't find that many films where no one dies. No one got AIDS. No one got gay bashed. It was impossible. And so you think about that. It is a dystopia. We just write our lives. Bravo. There you go. Dystopian fiction. But I think more important than that is this speculative fiction is not as queer as it should be, in my opinion. In that. If you think about people writing the future, they write a future where everyone's enlightened and there's no racism and and everyone can be whoever they want and robots do all the hard work and everyone's got great, lovely lives in these utopias, but there's never any queers. Mm-hmm. And that's really odd to me, which is why my novels, I've written three now, and each one is more queer than the one before. and mainly that's because I'm at the point now where no one's going to stop me.
When you've got a long career, do you notice, Bill, over the course of your books, a shift in the way people respond to it, or a shift in that kind of, for want of a less saccharine word, acceptance?
Well, I think for me, the change came with my memoir, Insomniac City. It was pure memoir. Before that, I'd written histories that had a personal narrative to them, but it wasn't pure memoir, and it was just letting people directly into my life. I moved to New York at age 48 to start over, to start fresh. I'd lost a partner in San Francisco and met Oliver Sacks, last person I expected to fall in love with and have a relationship with, but fell in love, so it sort of chronicles our love story as well. And it was the first time I published my photography. I had bought a camera when I moved to New York, and that's how I got to know New York and New Yorkers, was by taking photographs on the street and published them in that book. And to my surprise, people liked the photographs. And it was a way to get to know me and to get to know New York.
Yeah. I'm interested in audience and who you write for. When you're sitting down, do you have a reader in mind, not in a sense of the publisher's demographics, but a kind of imagined audience, Chris?
It depends on what book I'm writing.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the most recent book, Fat Girl Dancing, that I've written, originally I kind of hoped that it would be a book that connected with other people who are living in fat bodies or who are living in bodies that don't fit into the normal kind of, normal range as ordinary bodies. Mm. But ultimately I feel like it's a book that's connected with people who are in bodies that are quite normative because they haven't been able to imagine what it's like to live in the world in a fat body. And so to actually, for a thin person to read this book, I've had thin people come to me and say, I think I know what it's like to be fat from reading this book. Wow. And I have a new understanding and I think about spaces and the world and, places that you can't fit into. And I think about that more. So, even though my audience originally was other people in bodies similar to mine, it kind of, branched out from there really.
Yeah, it was interesting reading it. I didn't feel like it was pandering to a thin audience. And that was really delightful for me as a fat woman to read it. But perhaps that's why it was so effective. And I suppose
my people
have responded to it because it was, honest rather than didactic. Yeah, I mean, that applies as well to queer work, Are we writing to protect ourselves from straight judgment or are we writing... I mean, Claire, do you write for a specific audience, a queer audience?
Well, being, I suppose, in a way, the outsider's outsider as a queer Aboriginal woman, that's like, if you talk about the hierarchy of culture, we queer Aboriginal women are the bottom. And we can find our way up higher up this hierarchy ladder, but we start at the bottom. So being the outsider's outsider, I don't try and write for people like me because it'd be very, very hard to find people like me. What I write for is writing my work aimed at people who are as different to me as possible so they can feel some empathy for people like me.
Mm.
And, of course, being an outsider, you can actually... if you can make people feel empathy for the most outsider of outsiders, then you can make people feel empathy for almost anybody.
Mm.
It's like this idea of creating the biggest empathy possible, the broadening the out-group to contain all people is kind of what my writing is aimed at. So therefore I can't write for myself. I have to write self-indulgent work for other people to read.
I love that. Curly, what about you? Who do you write for?
I'm really digging this self-indulgence thing because I think earlier in my writing career, I believe that writing was so self-indulgent that we had to be of service. And so I think it really made my writing a lot more, conscious of the audience and really for First Nations kids and for teachers largely because I am a teacher. And I think now, like, this novel is so self-indulgent. I feel a little bit, one of my friends was like, are you the Taylor Swift of the Black Poets Girls? And I was like, watch out, exes, you're about to be writ in a book. but I do feel like there are, I mean, this character has romance with a black man, which is recent, and also with a white woman, recent. Like, these are things that have happened in my life, and I think something that happens for mob, and if you're queer and you're dating across genders, is that we do have the question of, like, are they blackfellas or what? Like, dating within culture and interculturally is also something that comes up. And so I think I want to put that perspective out there and just see how it lands, see who picks it up and who it feels relevant for. But, with the hope that it is self-indulgent and that somebody out there sees self in that.
There's this oddity that every now and then you get people say something like, what do you mean? Surely there's no such thing as a queer Aboriginal woman. And it's like, I don't think I know very many straight Aboriginal women, particularly not in the arts and literature.
Yeah.
I've made that joke at an event once and one person put up and said, what about me? It's like, okay, I know one straight Aboriginal woman. And that's how it feels sometimes. It's hard to find...
Because I don't believe, I don't really believe in straight people.
Mm. Same.
I really don't. I really have trouble imagining that. And I know you told me once, just try and imagine it as a fetish. I remember that. And that, I get that. I get it. You know,
I think straight sex is really kinky and weird.
It is. It totally is.
Not the act itself, just the notion of the limitation of straightness. It's not even heterosexuality. There's something about straightness. Like if you're the kind of, sorry to anyone in the room who identifies as straight, we accept you.
You were.
We tolerate. But yeah,
it's
always
a straight safe zone.
It seems novel to me.
Yeah.
Anyway, go on.
Yeah, it's just really weird that that people would limit themselves. But I do understand fetishes. I do understand that you have that. There's that. But for I've always found it really strange, and I've never slept with a straight person either. And I've slept with plenty of people that actually identify as straight people. But then when you get in the bedroom, like suddenly they're absolutely fine with your robots, you know, and you know whatever it is, they're kind of really happy to cosplay in different clothing. Like, you know,
I was trying to get along the line to ask Ben what audience he writes for.
Do
you write for straight people? I mean, your book. Straights would enjoy it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean...
They like rules. They rules. You know, but you teach us to bend those rules. So.
I'm odd man out here. I mean, A, one book down. Two, you know, so far. Two, it's a, you know, it's a language guide. It's a writing guide. But the one thing that was important to me is that it had to be mine.
Yeah.
You know, and it had to come out of my mouth. And as I was working on it, and I think that this is, I mean, I remember when I started to work on the book, all of my writer friends, including the ones that we published, they were all like, you know, snickering and saying, oh boy, are you going to find out what this feels like?
Yeah.
You know, and I remember it was like, you know, one of my writer friends said, you're going to go through every existential crisis that you thought you'd already been through, plus the ones you've never even heard of. And I wrote tens of thousands of words that were absolutely turgid and boring, and I deleted them. And then finally, there just came this moment, this sort of like click, where I started to write in what I believed to be my own voice. And I found it, finally. And once that happened, the rest of the writing process went really well. And the nicest thing... The nicest thing that happened was when, you know, when I finished the book, we went through the copy editing process, get to Bound Galleys. That was finally the time for me to share the book with my mom, who hadn't read a word of it, because I didn't want her to. And she read it and she said, it sounds just like you. Yeah. And I thought, good. And then, The flip side of that is that I will on occasion, you know, when I'm in an event like this or you know, or doing something, people will come up to me afterward and who've read the book and they say, you sound just like it.
Well, I loved reading your book, and writing you emails is incredibly stressful. and at a certain point, I just had to let go and realize that you wouldn't have time to copy edit my emails. So I hope you didn't judge me. But I actually read it and I thought only a queer person could write a book about like language and grammar rules this playfully and this personally. And I think there's something about that and a willingness to bend rules and play with them and make them personal that really appealed to me. And it's a rollicking good read. Like it's a page turner of a grammar book. I loved it. on that, we do have time for some audience questions. I believe there's roving microphones, and whilst they make themselves known, please ask a question. Please make it succinct. Please don't use up time praising people. You can praise them at the signing table when you buy their books afterwards. Yeah, don't make me interrupt you and go, you know, I'll take that as comment or get to the question. Look after the whole audience by asking a succinct question. That probably has
now
a question
everyone's
mark at the
end. Scared to ask
yes,
a question.
I've been praised before for my dominating Q&A manner. It's the only time I'm a top. Could somebody put their hand up if you've got a question and we'll get a microphone to you?
No. I also like how they look down too, right? They're like...
Have I been too terrifying? Do we have
Don't
any
be
questions?
That scared.
Oh, here we go. We've got one down here. I've got more I can keep going, but it's nice to hear from the audience. Briefly and succinctly.
It's sexy.
Thanks.
I'll try to be succinct. What book made you different? Oh, I love that. Who's got an answer for that? Bill?
I went to a very conservative Jesuit college in Northern California, and I had a great professor, Dr. Carolyn Mitchell, who taught women's literature. And it was she who introduced me to Zora Neale Thurston and Kate Atkinson and Joan Didion, but also Audrianne Rich. And it was her book, The Dream of a Common Language, that really blew my mind. It still does. I think it's such a beautiful book and so brave. She was already an acclaimed poet, had been married and had children, and in 1976 published a pamphlet, really, a suite of poems called 21 Love Poems, dedicated to her lover. And then The Dream of a Common Language came out after that. And there's one poem in particular I love, and if I have a moment, yeah. I'm just going to read
it. Did you read it? I'd love that.
Bit of it. This is it's a long poem, but I'm just going to read a short part. No one ever told us we had to study our lives. Make of our lives a study as if learning natural history. Sorry, I'm getting weird. As if learning natural history or music, that we should begin with the simple exercises first and slowly go on trying the hard ones, practicing till strength and accuracy become one with the daring to leap into transcendence. Take the chance of breaking down in the wild arpeggio or faulting the full sentence of the fugue. And in fact, we can't live like that. We take on everything at once before we've even begun to read or mark time. We're forced to begin in the midst of the hardest movement, the one already sounding as we are born. Everything else seems beyond us. We aren't ready for it. Nothing was said it's true for us, caught naked in the argument, the counterpoint, trying to sight read what our fingers can't keep up with, learn by heart what we can't even read, and yet it is this we were born to. We aren't virtuosi or child prodigies. There are no prodigies in this realm, only a half-blind, stubborn cleaving to the timbre, the tones of what we are, even when all the texts describe it differently. And we're not performers like Liszt, competing against the world for speed and brilliance. The longer I live, the more I mistrust theatricality, the fake glamour cast by performance. The more I know its poverty beside the truths we are salvaging from the splitting open of our lives. But there come times, perhaps this is one of them, when we have to take ourselves more seriously or die. When we have to pull back from the incantations, rhythms we've moved to thoughtlessly, and disenthrall ourselves, bestow ourselves to silence or a severe listening, cleansed of oratory, formulas, choruses, laments, static crowding the wires, we cut the wires, find ourselves in free fall, as if our true home were the undimensional solitudes, the rift in the great nebula. No one who survives to speak new language has avoided this, the cutting away of an old force that held her rooted to an old ground.
Beautiful, thank you. Did anyone else want to speak to what book made you different? Chris and Ben?
I think I'd just like to shout out to Eve Rees because Eve's book, All About Eve, I read recently to interview them for a panel, and it's all about their learning about being trans. And as I was reading the book, I kind of went, so what's different about your life and mine? And by the end of the book, I went, I'm breaking up with the gender binary. Like, that's not, it doesn't fit me. And it was Eve's book that did that for me.
It's beautiful. Yeah. Ben.
I mean, for me, the book that changed everything, and again, I've been thinking about, you know, the things that we're going to be talking about today, and just thinking about the very personal relationship that we as queer people have with the books that we embrace, and the way the literature and the life all sort of tend to melt together. And the book that I was thinking, I've been thinking about most is, and that I've been rereading this week, is Andrew Holleran's novel, Dancer from the Dance. And it was a very important book to me, because it was essentially given to me as a love token. And the experience of first reading it is all mixed in with the romance that surrounded it. And it's this swirlingly romantic novel, wonderfully overwritten, kind of camp, extremely sexy. One thing, I mean, this is maybe like the 10th, 12th, 14th time I've been reading it. It's like, I have to confess, I've been reading it thinking, God, does this book need a better copy editor than the one that it got? But it doesn't make any difference to me because it takes me back to being 22 years old.
There's something about... Oh, sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's...
There's something about the books we're gifted. I will always remember when I was 14 and absolutely passionately, unrequitedly in love with a 17-year-old prefect. And she gave me for my birthday a copy of Tess of the D'Urbervilles. And she wrote in the cover, I still have the book, A Woman's Tragedy. I thought it might be appropriate. What book made you different, Curly?
That's stunning. These books are books that I find surprising because, I mean, the people who write them are priests or, white fellas from England. But I've just had a really beautiful romance with a really lovely Irish woman, and when we'd sit down to dinner at night, we'd lay down, you know, this beautiful meal on a rug and sit down with all of the poets and then select a bunch of poems and read poems almost like prayers before dinner. It was stunning. And so John O'Donoghue, I mean, I'm never going to get enough of John O'Donoghue. Mary Oliver and David White and The Prophet were books that were on this stack, which I really enjoyed, and so was Ellen's Throat. But I think Alok Vaid Menon's book, its little purple pocket guide around gender, is such an incredible read, and it changed me. Reading that was, I really sat with this gender binary and thought, wow, this is messed up. And in the same way that straight feels like a fetish, you know, I think... Reading that, you just go, wow, all of these labels are really limiting the way that we experience love and romance and connection and the openness and the fullness of who we are.
Claire? This is a great question, by the way.
Again, I'll have to mention The Monkey's Mask because that I didn't know what writing was until I read that. And, for example, there's a couple, I can't find the lines in the, I've got an e-book of the book on my iPad. I can't find them right now. But if I remember them correctly, there's this bit where she writes, because it's a murder mystery set within poetry scene. So it's poets murdering poets, which is hilarious.
Real life, it's factual.
Yes, yes. but she said, I may be paraphrasing this a bit, but I just remember it so vividly. I never knew poetry could be about opening your legs 1 minute and opening your grave the next. I never knew that poetry could be as sticky as sex.
Oh, nice. I mean, we still have 4 minutes, but that's such a good line to end on. But I'm a stickler for a schedule, so do we have another question? We've got one down the front. The anticipatory silence.
Intimidating.
Thank you. The panel were discussing Tori Peters earlier and her incredible book. And obviously, she's a trans woman writing about trans issues. And I think a large part of the reason the book was so incredible was because she comes from that insider perspective. And following on from that discussion, what's your opinion on writers who aren't in the community? Should they be writing on queer issues? Should they have queer characters? And if not, are you sort of limiting the audience's exposure to those characters?
Great question. Do we have one of you want to answer?
I don't think there are straight people, so I think
that's Chris's answer. Claire, did you have a view?
I have a good answer to that one because it's similar to when I'm teaching writing workshops, which I do a lot, people often ask the obvious question for them, which is, can white people write Aboriginal characters? And it's the same sort of thing. And I think it's wrong to insert yourself because every character they write is actually to themselves deep down. You dig the depth of any character and you find the author. So you don't want a character from not your community that you deep. You don't want to dig into a queer character in like in a story and find they're straight underneath because a straight person wrote them. So what I always say is, if you want to have a queer character, and you should, there's nothing wrong with writing a straight protagonist, a straight narrator, with a queer friend. And then if there's any prejudices from the straight character, that's on the author then. And then they're not inserting the prejudices into the queer character. So that's kind of the only way to do it, really. If you're straight and you want to write queer characters, then don't write a queer protagonist. Please just don't do that. But you can write, for example, a queer character as a protagonist's best friend. And then if the protagonist is a homophobe, then everyone just know the writer's a homophobe, and that's your problem, not mine.
Early, you were lifting your mic.
You stole the words right out of my mouth. That's exactly what, and I have that question as well often. I really feel that way. I don't think we can be omitted anymore as black people, as queer people, as people existing in the community from so many different identities. I think, yeah.
I run a writing workshop, and I've been asked this question. I used to run a sex writing workshop at one point, and I had that question from someone: how can I write a queer character? And I said, well, it's research. Do your research. like, that is, you know, go out and have some queer sex and see if you like it. And if you like it, write about it, you know?
I love that. Ben, what do you do if a text comes across your desk that has queer protagonists but the author's not queer?
I mean, basically, I do try to hold to the notion that everybody should write precisely what they want to write. The test is whether or not it's persuasive when it's finished. We live in an era right now in publishing the era of the authenticity reader, which we used to call the sensitivity reader, but that term is frowned upon because it sounds like oversensitivity reader. So we're sensitive to that, and we changed it to authenticity reader. And we don't do it on every book that we publish, because not every book that we publish needs it. But there is this sort of thought that goes on. Would this book benefit from having an extra reader, having an authenticity reader come on? And we have this whole pool of people do this sort of thing. To date, actually, the readers have generated very few requests, comments, changes, which suggests that our writers are, in fact, doing their research, whether it's on issues of gender or sexuality or race, but, you know, anything out of the author's own sort of natural perspective. So I just sort of trust the process like I trust writers.
I suppose there's also the answer that you can write it, but then you also can't stop an audience telling you if you've failed. That the right to write it doesn't change the right to everyone else to tell you that you've fucked it up.
Yeah.
And on that note, that does bring us to 5:30. Can we please have a round of applause for this absolutely fabulous panel? Please purchase at least one of all of their books. You won't be disappointed. They're brilliant. The Queer Stories, the collection that I edited, I believe will be for sale. So hopefully you can buy a copy of that as well. Thank you so much for joining us. You've been a wonderful audience.
And thank you, Maeve. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this discussion and would like to support Melbourne Writers Festival, visit mwf.com.au/support.